Hello and welcome to Nerdette Recaps Game of Thrones with Peter Segal. I am Greta Johnson.
I'm Trisha Bobita, and we are joined by Peter Segal,
who is here to represent the patriarchy, or so I am told somebody said at a party this weekend. It was reported back to me.
I'm so glad to hear that.
The comment was, yes, this Game of Thrones podcast is fine, but I can't stand that Peter Segal is there representing the patriarchy. So from now on, everything I say will be, and the patriarchy believes.
Oh, good. I was thinking, you know, if you want, I could speak for the patriarchy.
She's pretty good at it, actually.
The patriarchy is giving you the little side eye here, because the patriarchy is a little worried about your loyalty to it. But move on, please.
Today we are rehashing Season 5, Episode 5 of Game of Thrones. This is your spoiler alert.
We're halfway through the season with an episode called Kill the Boy. I have to say, right off the bat, disappointed about the meaning of that title.
Yes.
But
we were all wondering what
soon.
Boy was going to get it.
I know.
Yeah.
And in this show, a boy could get it.
Yes.
Like, they would actually kill a child on Game of Thrones.
Boys, girls, horses, anybody.
Later in the show, we're also going to share some of your voicemails and try to answer some of the questions you've asked us in emails and Tumblr and such. So stay tuned for that as well.
If you're hoping for some Nerdette proper, you're in luck. We are back from our break between seasons with new episodes available for your ears. And make sure you never miss a Nerdette of any kind. Subscribe to us on iTunes. You can also find us on Stitcher, SoundCloud. Search for Nerdette wherever you subscribe to podcasts.
Also, we've got a disclaimer here that maybe probably doesn't need to be said, but we'll say it anyway. Game of Thrones is pretty, as I like to call it, HBO rated in terms of language and nudity and violence and all of that really fun, good stuff. When we talk about the show, we talk about some of that fun, good stuff. If that makes you uncomfortable, maybe you shouldn't be listening to this.
All right. So jumping right in, I will say that we are now firmly in the world of the TV show, veering farther and farther from the books.
Yes.
And I will say again that it's making for better television.
It certainly is.
Because we're spending more time in individual locations, getting more time with each character so that it's not quick 20 seconds of people riding through the forest. And now another place, another place, another place.
I was actually going to say that this episode, among many other virtues, shows the benefit of time. Because if I'm not mistaken, there was no scenes in King's Landing.
Right.
There were no scenes in Dorne. We've left Jaime and Bronn there. And what that meant was you only had three major plot lines to follow. Because of the consolidation of characters, there were fewer people involved. And that means you had these great scenes which were allowed to breathe. For example, the incredibly awkward dinner party. The world's worst dinner party ever. Worked so well because not only did they have enough scenes building up to it, but they also were allowed to play that out. The only thing wrong with it was when Ramsay totally went meta and said, well, this is rather tense.
Oh, my God.
But it was, and that's only because they're giving themselves finally some room to breathe without, as you say, all right, it's been 3 minutes, we got to get up to the wall, 4 minutes, we got to get back down to Dorne, which was nice.
I'm sorry.
Sorry about what?
For killing your brothers.
There. Over and done with. Doesn't everyone feel better? I do. That was getting very tense. You know what, my lady? What with him having murdered your brothers and the rest of your family gone, Reek here is the nearest thing to living kin that you have left. Reek! You will give away the bride. Someone has to. What better person? Good? Good?
Yes, yes, very good.
Worst family dinner ever. I think also to see how it plays out afterwards with then Ramsay talking to Roose, like the entire thing, you got to see the trajectory.
And that was also true of the scenes up at the wall. There was more space. There was more time. It was even true of the scenes with Daenerys and everything is allowed to progress. It's like, whoa, this is how drama works. This is really nice. I feel we should address, though, the very first pieces of information that we got in this episode, which is who lived and who died.
So let's start in Meereen then.
Right.
With Grey Worm healing.
First shot in the hospital, Greta.
I know. I thought that was so funny. You got your sick bed scene.
I got my little sick bed scene. But Barristan was dead, and I was half right. I predicted both would live. Did either of you predict that both were dead?
I think I did.
Yeah. So we'll split this. And, you know, I knew I was wrong prior to seeing the episode because people may not know this, but for the first four episodes, we had screeners. We were able to record the shows in advance. So the last episode's podcast came out. I listened to it, and I heard myself say, Grey Worm's going to live because we have that wonderful relationship with Missandei that they want to play out. And sure enough, That's the first thing
that's
you see.
Exactly what happened.
But then I heard myself say, well, Barristan is going to live because he's a great guy. and I knew hearing myself say that.
You said, Peter, you fool.
I know. When has that ever saved anybody in this show? And in fact, yes, they love killing off great guys, as we all know. And also, I forget which one of you ladies, because I confuse you, because you all look alike to me.
Good. Thank you.
Made the very good point that by getting rid of Barristan, they would make the need that Daenerys has for a really smart advisor that much more profound. And you were right, whoever said that.
It may have been me. I'll take credit for that.
Take credit, Trisha.
I am so gracious in spirit as a woman that I will let Trisha have the credit for that.
That's really nice. Barristan, though, we say a fond farewell to Barristan. I liked him a lot. Good guy, great actor. Don't know his name.
Yeah, but when you get a sunset scene where you talk about nice things,
absolutely.
You're dead.
It was over.
And I am ashamed that I did not see that. Because that conversation, that lovely little moment, was like a huge black vulture landing on his shoulder. So, yes. Well, apologies for screwing that up. But moving right along.
To Daenerys taking revenge.
Oh, that was pretty awesome.
For the loss of her dear friend and advisor.
Yes.
Oh my gosh, the dragon.
That was great.
Ooh. It was pretty great.
I am going to say something here. There are many other places in the episode where I could point it out. But this, we always talk about the costume design and the set design. The sound design in this episode was awesome. We do not give enough credit to that. The moment I noticed it, when they're standing there in the dungeon, you haven't seen the dragons yet, but you can hear the chains clanking. There were great sound moments in this. When later on in the show, when Sansa is walking down the line in the kennel and the dogs are barking really, really loudly, there's just great bits like that because they do a lot with sound. And you often, and I say this in apology to the sound designers in my life, you don't notice it. But that was pretty awesome.
You notice it when it's terrible.
Yes.
True.
Yes, that is true. And let's talk about Daenerys, because Daenerys's thing, or her, I don't know, segment of the episode, ends with her making a choice that I think was problematic for a lot of readers of the books. This one is in the books, where she chooses to marry, and I will not even pretend to remember that guy's name.
The guy who is the former master, who's a part of her council.
Yes. And that was annoying when you come across it in the book, A Dance of Dragons, because why is she doing this? Part of it is a general impatience, like, why is she sticking around in Meereen when she needs to get back to Westeros and kick butt immediately?
I came here to tell you that I was wrong. I was wrong, and you were right. About tradition. About bringing the people of this city together. I will reopen the fighting pits. To free men only. Slavery will never return to Meereen. Not while I live.
Yes, my queen.
And in order to forge a lasting bond with the Meereenese people, I will marry the leader of an ancient family. Thankfully, a suitor is already on his knees.
She just seems to be tying herself to that city when that's not where any of us want her to be, including, we thought, herself.
But doesn't he have a bunch of boats? Am I making that up?
I don't know.
I feel like in the books, a big part of the marriage arrangement was you need my resources for you to be able to move on and do
this. As I remember it, basically she's trying to, as she is in the TV show, solve her problem, which is that the people of Meereen are rising up in the streets and she has no control and she needs to somehow establish herself as the ruler of Meereen. How she is in her own mind is connecting that with raising her army and sailing over the sea. And
yeah, we seem to have lost sight of that eventual goal in this storyline.
And did you guys buy her transition from rage to bloody vengeance to reconciliation?
No.
You didn't?
I didn't see it as reconciliation. I thought of it as just a new way of having power. Because this guy still understands that he is either going to marry her or get crispified by the dragon. It's not like she's like, reconciliation, this is the way to do it. She's realized that she has to seem as though she's playing along with the traditions and seem as though she's doing these things.
Speaking of being crispified for the dragon, I do want to pay homage, as we did last week, to the ship's captain, to the poor guy who was made into the extra crispy lunch special. Because again, it's like, great news, I got you a part in Game of Thrones. Terrific. What am I doing?
I also thought it was nice that the dragons share.
They rip them in two and then they eat side by side. They actually eat got almost the same amount, which was nice.
Danny taught them that sharing is caring.
If they were my siblings, they would have complained to her. Like, she got a bigger piece.
Yeah, totally.
Not my siblings, my children. Sorry. Freudian slip there. Best line of the show. You don't want to overfeed them.
Yeah.
Oh, eye roll. Awesome.
Okay, so we had very different opinions about that line of dialogue. Peter enjoyed it very much.
I thought it was a little too much.
Yeah.
Of course
she wants to overfeed them. Are you kidding me? They're fine.
Welcome back to Nerdette Recaps Game of Thrones with Peter Sagal. I'm Trisha Bobita along with Greta Johnson, and Wait, Don't Tell Me's Peter Sagal. If we continue on to what's going on with our pal Tyrion.
You want to move on to the last segment of the show, which is Tyrion and Najora?
I think so.
Let's stick with the geography this week.
We're in Essos.
I did notice in the credit sequence they had to go across the narrow sea twice, which seemed an inefficient use of a fake moving camera.
I can't do this.
You have to fly over there and you have to look at, you know, the Braavos and then you have to fly back. And
did we really need Braavos? Because we get no Braavos.
Does the fake flying camera get a frequent fake flyer miles?
Yeah.
All right. Sorry. Yeah. Moving on.
Thanks. I have to say this was my favorite scene of the episode, I think.
It might even be
my favorite yet. I don't know if suspense is the right word, but that buildup right at the very end when he's looking down at his wrist and the music swells and then it just cuts to black. The whole thing in there, I loved it.
They also did something I have been waiting for ever since I was an obsessive watcher of The Sopranos, because in The Sopranos, there might have been earlier shows that had this effect, but in The Sopranos, you watched the show in increasing tension, waiting for it to be over because something terrible you knew was going to happen. And as soon as the black came, the blackout at the end of The Sopranos, you knew that the threat was over for the week. And that has been, it seems to me, to be a lot of shows are written that way, that with tension, blackout, Breaking Bad, many others. This is the first time I've ever seen a producer use that to fool you, because it blacks out with Tyrion going into the water for a long time. What's the next thing I'm going to see? Is it the credits? No, I've never seen anybody else sort of try that little trickery, and I kind of admired it. Did you guys think for a second that Tyrion was doomed?
No.
No, absolutely not.
Among other things, we've seen pre-production stills of him, you know, off in some other place he hasn't reached yet, so no.
I'm pretty sure Jorah is doomed, though.
Yeah.
I mean, I think he was anyway, but...
Yeah.
I liked someone's tweet I saw last night that was like, "Eat that, Walking Dead. We have so many kinds of zombies on our show. # Game of Thrones."
Yes.
Because now we get to see a fight with a new kind of zombie,
They're still alive. They're sort of transformed by their disease in some way. Somebody else pointed this out. I think it was some other recap I checked this morning. But it is wonderful to see how much the budgets have increased because they have so much more money for really cool computer-generated scenes and scene matching. So you get that amazing sequence in the ruins of old Valyria with those stuntmen dressed up as stone guys. And it was awesome. And they couldn't probably have done that in the first season of the show before it became the most popular TV show in the world. And
ever.
HBO says, how much money do you need? You need this? Take the money.
And isn't the most expensive thing ever on any set always when there's a boat? Isn't that just the most expensive because it takes so much time and energy to get it set up and the light moves so quickly?
Who knows?
But it tends to be the most expensive real IRL thing to do on a set is to be in actual water in an actual boat.
And I have read actually the computer-generated images are actually much more expensive even now.
Even still?
But who knows? But anyway, the show just... I know. I should probably say something bitter and mean because I'm totally out of character here by praising their technical accomplishments and their acting.
No, this is good. I think every once in a while we should throw them a bone.
Moving on. But yeah, that poor Jorah. And it was nice to see the sort of the old nice Jorah come back. Mm. The Tyrion kind of teased it out of him.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of lovely when he finished reciting that poem.
I do like the Mormont way also.
Oh, that's the Mormont way.
Sullen silences broken up by occasional punches in the face.
Did you guys feel this episode there were a lot of moments where, I know this is a weird thing to say about a made-up place, but a lot of anachronistic statements, you know, like his line, like punches in the face.
Hmm.
Did they say punching in the face? When Ramsay says to his very naked girlfriend, "That's my priority right now." Priority? You know, I mean, there just seems to be, maybe it's also because, and I should confess this, I have been rereading the books because there's not enough obsession in my life,
Peter,
of Game of Thrones.
Oh,
and one of the things I had forgotten is how incredibly humorously antique the language is in the books. Like, they don't dislike people. They mislike people.
Ooh.
They don't see things. They espy them.
Really?
Which is just the most horseshit sort of stuff. And to hear, you know, in contrast, the TV characters speaking as if they were just for an instant on Mad Men is kind of funny.
I think the Jon Snow scenes up at the north, if we go with Jon Snow all the way up to the wall, I think there was a lot of that too with the Night's Watch guys.
Yeah.
There's a lot of sort of like bro culture stuff that the language is a little too new maybe for the books,
yes.
But it fits in with the show and it's fine. It's okay.
So I don't want to be too book spoilery about everything that happens up at the wall, but like every time I see Maester Aemon, I'm just like, how is that guy still alive? Every time.
What do you mean? Because he's so old?
Yeah. Well, yeah. And doesn't he die? Shouldn't he have died a long time ago?
I honestly don't think so.
Really?
I don't think so.
I just can't believe that guy is still alive.
I think there's some assumption that Targaryens are kind of long-lived. But at any rate, but it is weird that he is that old.
Yeah. He says he's
almost 100 and freezing to death.
He was pleasantly bitter. He said, do it. They hate you anyway.
I love that.
He's become a bitter old Targaryen, which I kind of like.
So do you think he'll live long enough then to meet Dany?
I don't know.
Because that was, like, they set up this kind of
wistful... And who sent him the note, by the way?
That is a good question.
You see? Mm. Yeah. And more nice Stannis.
Okay, I am
what are we doing here?
On Team Stannis now than I was before.
He was nice to his daughter. Now he was nice to Sam Tarly. Pretty soon he'll be, like, throwing coins to the homeless. He's awesome now.
He's pretty great now.
That's
Greta.
Funny. I didn't think of him as being nice to Samwell as much as I thought of him as... trying to use Sam to get as much information as he
needs.
Like, I think he's
Sam.
Like, he's skirting around John to get to Sam.
Think about that scene, because we remember from the first season that Sam Tarly was completely rejected by his father, who basically said, join the Night's Watch or I'll kill you. He was utterly rejected by the other brothers because he's a craven, as they like to say. So here comes the king of the north, or the king, or a guy who calls himself king, and he says, I knew your father. Your father was an amazing warrior. You don't look like a warrior. And Sam's like, yes, I know. And then Stannis says, what are you doing? You're doing this. That is a good thing to do.
Yeah.
Keep doing that thing, Samwell Tarly. Who else has said that to him in the entire series other than Jon Snow? So there we are. Obviously, we are being set up Stannis-wise. Right? We're like, oh, he's nice to his daughter, and he's nice to Sam. He is about to do something just totally hateful.
So speaking of which, how do you think Roose Bolton knows that Stannis plans to march on Winterfell? I mean, is that just like an obvious strategic
move? He had the map, and I love the little sort of flayed men, little symbols representing Bolton soldiers. Well, it's all very obvious. Stannis is at the wall. They know that. He wants King's Landing,
and
Winterfell is on the way, just like Roose says. And my crush, by the way, on the actor playing Roose Bolton is growing every single day. Even when I'm not watching the show.
Even not on Sundays.
On Sundays. Like today, we're recording this Monday morning, my crush on Michael McClellan is greater than it was last night. He's so awesome. It'll be still greater tomorrow. My love for him grows. I actually went on IMDb and I said, I shall find things that he is in so I can watch them while waiting for the next episode. And he's just done a lot of British TV, and he was in the Glenn Close cross-dressing movie Albert Nobbs.
Of course he was.
Of course he was. So I need to go see that. But I'm guessing he won't be evil, and therefore I won't like him.
How did he manage to, in that one monologue, describe murdering a man and then raping that man's wife while his body hung overhead?
It was pretty good.
And then make you still feel like the point of that story was to make his son feel good.
Yeah.
It was the weirdest bit of acting incredible.
That is grandmaster level villainy. And when I was looking around for stuff about him on the internet, I came across an interview he had done, I think with Vulture online, about this very episode. And he said that while they were shooting that amazing dinner party scene, they were constantly getting the giggles. The actors.
Makes me so happy.
Because everything was so freaking awkward and evil that all the actors, of course, know how awkward and equal they're. And they just start laughing at all the evil things they're required to do. I hope that there is a end of season outtake reel in which we get to see the Boltons and Fat Walda and Sansa cracking up.
I do really want to see that. I wrote down in my notes that the most terrifying thing perhaps ever would be to attend the Bolton School of Management. Can you imagine?
effective. Effective,
yeah, man.
Though.
You know? Like,
you know, rule the North the Bolton way.
Oof. So intense.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Well, I've often thought that, I remember making this joke on Twitter when I was first reading the first book, that you could look at Game of Thrones as sort of a parenting manual.
Could you?
You know, no, you, I mean, this was before I got to the second and third books, but it'd be like, you know, Rob, not Joffrey, parenting the Game of Thrones way. Because seriously, so much, how many father-child, especially father-son, but also father-daughter, mother-daughter relationships are absolutely central to this. And the way the kids go different ways, very much dependent on who their fathers are. I mean, it'd be one thing if Ramsay Bolton was a monster and his father wasn't.
Right. That's the whole thing about that monologue, is that it does get you to think, oh, this is not entirely Ramsay's own doing. Like,
yeah.
He started.
He came by his homicidal madness, honestly.
Very honestly.
I do love, though, that Sansa, although she is realizing now that this is an even worse situation probably than she was expecting for her, is also kind of looking at Ramsay like, I've dealt with Joffrey. You ain't got nothing on crazy, you know, betrothed people. Because
sociopaths.
I'm also, in terms of anticipation, what's coming next, getting a little impatient with Sansa to do something. We talked prior about how Sansa seems to be coming into her own, how Littlefinger gave her that great speech. It's like, you got to fight back. And here she is floating around, and she hasn't done anything yet. The only thing she's done is when Fat Walda, and I'm sorry, that's what she's called in the books, Fat Walda,
don't write in. It's perfect.
When she says, I'm pregnant, and Sansa has that little smile and says, oh,
I'm so happy for you.
That's it. That's like the only even mildly active thing she's done.
Well, she does start the conversation, though, when Walda says, it must be so strange for you to be here. And she says, this is my home. The people are strange.
Well, I know, but it's still kind of reactive. I want her to play a card soon, and I want it to be a good one.
I think she took in some valuable information this time around. But if nothing happens with her in the next episode, I'm going to complain about it a lot.
All right.
So get ready for that.
We will be drafting our angry letter here.
So when it came to that scene at the kennels, did either of you think, oh, we're going to see a dire wolf?
Like, I was hoping for somebody's dire wolf.
We need to stop and talk about, what is her name, Melinda?
Yeah,
Miranda, because A, sympathy for that poor actress who got one big dramatic scene. We've never seen her before, right? And she had to do it entirely naked, which is not easy. It's one thing. I mean, exposition while naked is ridiculous. Dramatic acting while naked is challenging. And, you know, credit to the actor, the Welsh actor who plays Ramsay as well, because he was just as naked, even though, as per usual, Greta's mother is disappointed because there is no D. I mean, imagine that. It's like you've got this very difficult scene. You're establishing your characters, the relationship between your characters, and you're both Starkers. Go. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. There was a noise offset. Could we please run that again? This is naked dramatic scene, take 14.
Yeah,
oh,
especially that expression on her face right towards the end.
Oh, yeah. She's like, I got him.
Yeah, so
using
intense.
My wiles. And that scene, again, more and more time. I love this. She's picking at Sansa's clothes. And, oh, where did you get this? That was really wonderful and creepy, and they took their time. It was awesome. Although I had a question about her clothing. She was wearing this weird S&M-style tight leather dress, which I thought was a lot for the daughter of the Master of Hounds. But, you know, maybe she saved up.
He could have bought it for her. I wouldn't have been surprised if he had bought that for her, don't you think?
Just to make sure that we get it in, rack and butt count, one of each.
One of each, yeah.
From the scene
much.
We're talking about.
Yeah, that was pretty much it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that
and
was
one
okay.
bloody lip.
Yes.
And some grayscale.
Yeah.
And some grayscale.
A little bit, yeah. And some navels because, you know, always with Daenerys's and Missandei's outfits, it's just like, you know, you can't see their navels.
Did we discuss the wall enough and what is happening?
Do we need to go back to the wall?
I just wanted to make sure that everybody felt good about what happened.
Let me do the fake camera. Going back to the wall.
Good. Thank you.
I mean, this is interesting because obviously we've talked before in the show about, you know, why do people follow other people? What's the nature of command? What do you have to do? This is something George R. R. Martin is fascinated with. And as he says, you know, and as we see in the meeting room scene, he's doing this thing that we know because we've seen what he's seen that is absolutely necessary, but nobody else sees. And we had talked before, I think, about his relationship with Ollie.
I thought Ollie was going to become more and more important, and he got a lot of dialogue in this.
So the question is, why is John interested in Ollie? And I think that it's all sympathy that he says, you know, I know what it's like to lose everybody. That's why he took him under his wing. And you thought that
I think that he knows that Ollie's the only one who knows just how much he broke his vows and just how much he loved a wildling.
I think that John is being sentimental and will pay for it.
And I don't care. So I feel like we've got the whole spectrum on feelings about all of
that's where you took out your phone and played what?
Yeah,
played
that's
Bejeweled?
What,
I mean, during those scenes?
I mean, Tetris is fun.
That's true.
I feel pretty good about Tetris. I remembered why we needed to go back to the wall.
Why?
And it is to discuss the title of the episode, which is Kill
the Boy. But no actual boys were killed in this episode, which made me a little sad because, you know, yes, we're kill the boy, be the man, says Aemon.
And so John and Redbeard, who probably has a character name that's not Redbeard, but, you know, the wildling with the big red beard, decide that if they want to go get the rest of the free folk to fight, that what they're going to have to do is go get them. And the only way they'll be convinced that getting onto these ships, which are, by the way, borrowed from Stannis, if they're going to get on these ships and not think that they're going to just be, you know, burned to a crisp at sea as soon
as
they step on them, John's got to be on
Thrones.
Would be a pretty cool move.
Right.
But John has to be then on the ship as well. So John is now leaving the wall with Redbeard to go get the rest of the free folk.
Yeah.
Stannis has left with his army. And so basically what? Sam's in charge? I don't know. But not very many people are left at the wall at the end of this episode.
There's not a lot of well, actually, that's sort of the problem is there's not a lot of brothers to fight the incoming horde of dead people. Just parenthetically, I think that it would be a lot easier to understand the Night's Watch hostility toward the wildlings if the wildlings weren't clearly actors who had gone to the same drama schools in England with the guys playing the blood. I mean, they all have the same accent.
Yeah, that accent.
It's like, yes, we all studied together at RADA. We know we're on the same side. I think that perhaps they might have tried a little harder to make the wildlings a little more exotic. Just saying. More alien.
That's fair. One thing I did think was really interesting about the Night's Watch in general that I don't think we talked about last time around with the selection of Jon as the new leader is that this is really the closest group of people that we're seeing to an actual democracy.
Strange but true.
Which I do find really strange but true, especially given the fact that these are all criminals and...
Crawl criminals, rapers. I'm going to go with George R. R. Martin because why does he call them rapers? I don't know. They call them rapists of the show, but rapers, all those guys. It's interesting because it is, of course, a democracy. They get to select their own leader from among their ranks, but if you leave, they'll cut your head off.
Yeah.
So it's a limited democracy.
That's fair. But even, you know, seeing them all sort of discussing what they should do next and letting everyone have equal voice, at least in the discussion of it, I just thought was really, like, you just don't see that anywhere else in the Seven Kingdoms. I thought it was noteworthy.
Okay.
Noteworthy.
Yes. Thanks, guys.
And coming up in just a minute,
I'm sorry, was I yawning? That was, I was playing Tetris.
Coming up.
It's fun, huh?
I thought, come for the nudity, come for the demonstrations of civics, whatever. It's all Game of Thrones.
Exactly.
Go on.
Still to come in just a minute, we're going to go through some of your voicemails, emails, tweets, and react to the qualms that you've had with us or the questions you've had for us, so stick around.
You're listening to Nerdette Recaps Game of Thrones with Peter Segal. I'm Greta Johnson here with Trisha Bobita and Peter Segal. We love hearing from our listeners, and you guys have had a lot to say lately.
Voice call received 5:57 a.m. Thursday, May 7th.
My name is Christina, and I love listening to your show each week. The one thing that I want to suggest for an upcoming show is the analysis of the names of the characters on Game of Thrones. For example, Podrick can't just be Patrick. I have so much trouble remembering the names of all these characters because they're always just a little bit off. Perhaps that's why Jon Snow is so easily remembered and recalled, because his name is so easy to remember. But there's so many characters that you just can't really grab their names. It doesn't come out of your mouth so easily. I'd love to hear your analysis of the names of the characters on Game of Thrones. Thanks. Love you guys.
That is a really interesting question. And the short answer is I don't know, although I've thought about it a lot.
Of course you have.
Because I have nothing else to do with my life. There are a weird agglomeration of names in this show, which all of which come from the books, with the possible exception of Rob's late wife, who was invented for the TV show. Mm. And the names are a weird combination of common, even American names like Robert and strange made-up names
Eddard.
Like Sansa, mm-hmm. Eddard, who is called Ned. It's all very strange. There's a Roger in there somewhere. There's all kinds of names. And then there are weird variations on standard names, like Jamie, spelled J-A-I-M-E. And the answer is, I have no idea why he does these things. I have made this comparison before. George R. R. Martin is just one of those crazy people. Seriously, he's like a crazy guy with talent. And he just sits around and makes all this stuff up. Again, I referenced earlier, I was reading the first book over, and as strange and silly as some of the language is, including the agglomeration of names, everything is already there. He mentions in passing characters that you don't know yet, but you know he knows who they are. And in book two, like Lord Stannis never appears, but he knows when he talks about Stannis, he's got it all figured out who Stannis is. He has these relationships between characters that he already knows about. So all I can tell you is that when he was sitting around with his little painted figurines populating the thousands of characters in Game of Thrones, he came up with names. Maybe he made up those syllables and connected them together. He's like, I don't know if you've ever had a child who made up names for their toys or their stories they're telling. They're always strange combinations of real names and fake names that seem themselves like they were made up from real names. And I honestly think it's no more than that. George R. R. Martin says himself that he doesn't build worlds. He doesn't have like the language skills of a Tolkien, all of whom names had some sort of weird philological root because that was Tolkien's expertise.
I wish it was that it was about the real people in his life who he was just doing the really sloppy work of changing their name slightly. He lived in Uptown in Chicago, the neighborhood where Greta and I live, when he was writing the first book, and he had a bunch of roommates and a bunch of cats, and I wish there was one that was just like a good guy who was kind of put upon named Stan, and like that became Stannis.
Maybe.
But
you never
maybe
know.
We'll never know.
There, every now and then he'll put in like a reference to a real person. Like I believe there is a reference to Bill Belichick in one of the books. Because it's true. He is a huge football fan, and he hates the Patriots because I think he's a Giants fan. And so you can write in and correct me, but I will try to find this and we'll post it. But I believe, just for the heck of it, in some parenthetical historical reference, oh, in that battle, Sir This. Oh, yes, it's Sir Belichick, or a variation of Belichick, who was killed by a Giant.
Wow.
In some reference to a battle. That is true. We'll throw that in.
Fantasy football.
Yeah. Literally. I almost wonder, too, if this is one of those points where, having read the books, it is easier to keep track of the names.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, in the books, which are all told in the third person, even when they're from somebody's point of view, the names are constantly being repeated. Podrick thought, Podrick did, Podrick went. And obviously, on TV, you only hear the names where somebody says it. So, yes, for example, when I was watching The Wire, I couldn't keep track of anybody. I had to read recaps to figure out who had just done what.
Yeah, it's tricky. It's hard stuff.
It's a lot of people
funny
names.
I had never thought of Podrick as a variation of Patrick, but I suppose it absolutely is.
Yeah.
Here's a message from our Tumblr from Del Nakamura, who has a twofold question. I think we're just going to tackle the second part here, because this isn't something we've really talked much about, and it's, how does Cersei not know that Littlefinger is with Sansa and helped her escape from King's Landing? If so, shouldn't she be upset with him? If she doesn't know, isn't it a strange coincidence that Littlefinger suddenly left King's Landing at the same time Sansa did?
Well, that's a good point. In other words, why doesn't... I mean, Sansa disappeared.
Right.
After what they call the Purple Wedding, that is, when Joffrey choked to death. When I say they, I mean fans. George R. R. Martin doesn't call it that. And Sansa disappeared, Tyrion disappeared. I believe the assumption that somebody voices, if not in the TV show and the book, is that they were in it together and they vanished together.
So then why isn't she suspicious of the fact that Littlefinger's also been gone for that exact same amount of time?
That is an interesting question. Remember, Littlefinger left because he said, I have to go back to King's Landing because I can't make her suspicious through my absence. So maybe that is the reference to that. And who the hell knows what Cersei is thinking? She's not the clearest thinker. Right?
I also, like, even if Cersei were upset about it, I could also see an argument for the sake that she can't, like, she has to have Littlefinger on her side, you know? She can't possibly actually be angry at him because she needs him so much.
There's also the sense that people don't understand how ambitious Baelish is, and that he himself is a power to be reckoned with, which is sort of how Baelish likes it. And so it's possible that she, with her obsessions, concerns, and worries, just forgot to think about this guy. Remember that one of the interesting things about Baelish is, unlike everybody else, is he doesn't come from a noble house. And the only other contenders for the throne are high nobility. He's a little lordling from a far-off place in the Vale. And he's not going to be that for long. In fact, already technically he is the Lord of the Vale.
He's moving on up because chaos is a ladder.
Yes, it is. And the moon door is an opportunity. So it's possible, I mean, just guessing, that Cersei just doesn't think of him as a threat. He's also very useful. He raises a lot of money for the throne.
Yeah, I think it's more to her advantage to not overthink that.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a double, triple agent so much of the time that I think everyone assumes that Baelish is always on their side because he's always double-crossing somebody else.
Right.
Mm. He plays on that notion a lot, I think. Here's one from Abby, who sent us a message on Tumblr as well, and wants us, please, oh please, to address the apparent romantic feelings between Jaime Lannister and Brienne, because when they sail by Tarth, he gets heart eyes. Basically.
Oh, yes. I did notice those
he
eyes.
He does. It was very nice.
Very intentional heart eyes in that
scene. I don't know,
though.
I didn't really think of it as heart eyes as just like humanity eyes.
Human eyes.
You know, like, oh, Jaime is not an asshole all the time.
As we have talked about in regards to a lot of other characters on this show, Jaime is really, I'll be HBO about it, fucked up for no reasons of his own. He's only had, as he confesses at one point, intimate relations, and I mean that in many senses of the word, with one person, his own sister. And when you meet him, he has no other alliances. He has no friends. In fact, he, as he reflects upon in the second book and in the second and third seasons of the TV show, sort of lives in this strange isolation, which he understands is part of being the Kingslayer. And he reflects on the fact that no one will ever understand or appreciate why he felt he had to do that, and he's suffering the consequences. So he has nobody in the world. Everybody either fears him or hates him except for his sister. So finally he meets this woman. And whatever his feelings about her as a woman may be, and with Brienne, you know, that's complicated because of the way she carries herself, it's literally his only friend to this point.
Yeah.
The only person who he's ever had any kind of intimacy with, and I mean that in the PG sense.
In the human way.
In the human way, other than his own sister. So for him, that would be huge, you know, just this amazingly important thing in his life that he probably doesn't know how to deal with.
And somebody who shares what drives a lot of his actions, which is this sense of duty and honor and being misunderstood. And I mean, they had good times on the road.
They did. It was fun. Oh, remember that time we killed those guys? That was great.
Yeah, I have always really enjoyed their relationship, but never actually wanted them to consummate it in a physical way.
Yeah, I don't think they do either.
Yeah.
Certainly, I mean, I think Brienne feels a great fondness for Jaime, but I don't think either she or he are wired that way.
No, I think it's better that, like, friends. They're just friends.
They're just friends.
Heart eyes as they pass the island.
It's a good friend zone to be in, is what we're saying.
So we also got a really great email from someone named Mike. And he says, is there any situation too serious to be answered with a Game of Thrones stock phrase? And he has some really good examples. House Republicans are going to drive us off a fiscal cliff. Words are wind. Climate change threatens us all. It is known. Chris Christie announces for the presidency, the night is dark and full of terrors. And then my favorite one, obviously, there's a 40% off winter sale at JCPenney's. Winter is coming.
It is, yes.
It's good.
Lord knows I've been living my life this way. So why not apply to larger, you know, it's like, you know, it is known.
It is known.
It is known.
So say we all.
That's so say we. That's more Battlestar Galactica.
It is Battlestar Galactica, but, you know, it's
but
one
it
of my favorites.
True.
And it's good for a lot of stuff.
And of course, you know, every house has its words, which is somewhat silly, but still kind of fun. Hear me roar. We do not sow. You could basically, there is a famous episode of The Wire in which an entire scene is played out with just the word fuck said in different ways as Bunk and McNulty investigate a murder. And you could probably do a similar scene just by using these stock phrases. You know, winter is coming. It is known. You know nothing. And
I do definitely say you know nothing, Jon Snow, at people a lot.
I said it. I got to say it to George R. Martin. I said, you know nothing, George R. R. Martin. It was fun.
You know, that reminds me, too. We got an email that I was hoping we could discuss for. You might remember the specifics a little better than I do, Tricia, but it was someone who says that he likes to refer to George R. R. Martin as George Double R. Martin. Do you remember this
George
one?
George 2 R's Martin.
George 2 R's Martin.
In reference to the Monty Python.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Monty Python, the scene we go up in the tavern, right, where Brienne is sort of outside Winterfell, and the guy comes in the cap. I so much wanted that to be a guy from Monty Python and the Holy Grail. Which he said, hey, you. And he said, yes. Because you got the same little cap. I was like, oh.
Yep.
I thought that would have been hilarious.
Oh, we forgot to costume
specifically
this guy.
If it was Terry Gilliam from Monty Python and the Holy Grail, who was like, I forget who he played, and he's like, hello? Yes.
I think that you will need to probably reenact that for us so that we can make it a GIF for the Tumblr.
Yes.
Yep.
That
yep.
Because you know they're Monty Python fans. Did you know that about the scene in front of Marine? I think it was last season, where, you know, the one horseman comes out?
Yeah.
And Daenerys' mercenary friend kills him. Well, when he's shouting in Marinese or whatever it is, this is literally true. What he is shouting is their translation into their made-up language, but it really is a translation of the things that the French knight shouts
about the
in
sparrow
Monty Python
and
the Holy Grail. No, it's like, I fart in... What he's yelling is...
I fart in your general direction.
I fart in your general direction. So you smell of elderberries. And that is a true Monty Python Game of Thrones tie-in.
Oh, my God.
So I bet they costumed that guy to look like Terry Gilliam in Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
So that is a good... That is a good prompt, because I bet there are other Easter eggs like that in the show. So if you're a fan of Game of Thrones and Monty Python and you can find some more of those for us, send them to us. You can get those to us by leaving us a message on our Tumblr. That's nerdatpodcast.com, and then click on the part that says Nerd at Recaps. Or you can call us and leave a voicemail. That's 312-948-4687.
Oh, I have a specific question. Maybe mm-hmm. somebody can help me out. Maybe you guys can help me out. During the scene in which Jon Snow is telling the brothers, the Night's Watch, of his plans, and they're objecting and they're yelling, they cut to Stannis watching, and he says something.
He mutters a word.
He mutters a word, and Davos says, what? And he says, nothing. And I thought he said Theon. And what I was thinking was, well, he's like comparing it to Theon trying to take control of Winterfell and not succeeding. But what would Stannis know about that? Or what? Stannis never would have seen that or known anything about that. So what did Stannis say? If you guys know, if you heard it and you're sure about it, or you're just a good guess, write in and let us know.
Is this when I should admit that sometimes I watch things with closed caption just for fun?
Do you know what he said?
I didn't watch this on closed caption this morning.
But this is a good way to find this out.
Yeah.
So when you do, tweet at us, at NerdUpPodcast on Twitter, and make sure that you let at Peter Sagal know as well.
Please, please.
Very important. The show is produced by us with help from our WBEZ cohort, especially Joe Dassault, Colleen Pellissier, and Brad Helm.
Our theme music was composed by Andrew Edwards of Blue Police Box Music.
You can find links to all of the things, including the sign-up thingy for our weekly email newsletter thingy at nerdatpodcast.com.
You can listen to us wherever you're listening to us, because you already are, but we'd appreciate it if you took the plunge and subscribed on iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud.
We share links to things we like on Facebook, which you can see if you like us there, and we're on Twitter at NerdUpPodcast and would very much like to discuss all of the things.
Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect nerds like you. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org.
Throw us some stars and write a review if you're feeling generous, like the excellent S.A. Granville did on Stitcher. All right. Thanks, Peter.
Thank you, guys. Always a pleasure.